Hi, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends and colleagues. A very warm welcome to Michal Deckel. We are meeting today in Constance, which gives us the opportunity for this very special interview. We first met in Madrid in 2019 at the very first International Memory Studies Conference. I remember her rushing from lecture to lecture, carrying a book under her arm, and she told me that she had just finished writing it, and during the breaks of the conference, she was working on the index. This book, Tehran Children, a Holocaust Refugee Odyssey, appeared later in the same year, 2019. It drew a lot of attention in big newspapers and earned a lot of praise. I was lucky to convince a German publisher to create a German translation, which was published in 2021. And I was also allowed to contribute an afterword. Michal, you just arrived this morning via Zurich in Constance on your first trip to Germany. So we now have a chance to celebrate the German edition of your book and also have a chance to discuss it. Coming to Germany for the first time is not at all easy for the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. And you have a special reason for making a detour tomorrow on your way to Berlin. Can you tell us why you planned this trip and what lies ahead of you?
And as well as the translator, Tobias Gabel, who did a great job. This is, in fact, the first time I'm actually holding a physical copy of the German edition, which came out during the pandemic. So I had no chance to really see it before now. In terms of the question of coming here and making the special trip, first of all, this is my first time in Germany, but my grandfather, in fact, is buried in Munich, or rather in Gauting, right next to Munich. My grandfather died in a displaced persons camp in Munich, in a hospital right near there, and he's buried there, and I've never visited his grave. So this is, for me, a very special occasion to be able to do that. Aside from that, I'll be giving interviews in various venues, and it'll be a chance to reach a wider audience in Germany, which I'm very pleased about. The book has already drawn some attention. I've gotten some emails and messages from German readers, and I'm pleased to see that people are relating to it on all kinds of levels, both as a Holocaust book, but also as a book about refugees and migrants and so on.
The topic of our Madrid conference and our first conversations were the relations between national and transnational memories. Your family memory is not framed by national history or memory, but was sparked by personal transnational contacts and approaches. With Sana from Iran and Sergei from Uzbekistan, these are two of your protagonists, you were able to work on your book with transnational guides. Can you tell us something about this unique process of creating a family memory with the help of such interlinkages and intercultural networks of knowledge? My particular question is this perhaps also a version of multi-directional memory, a form of caring and custody, of preserving and valuing each other's memory, mutually witnessing each other's history?
Yes, thank you for that question. Yes, I believe it is. I believe the answer is positive. I began this as a family memoir, but a memoir of my father, who was a Holocaust refugee in central Russia, in the Soviet interior, in Uzbekistan, in Iran, India, and Palestine. So this was the story of my father, but the story of my father is not just the story of my father. First of all, it's the story of a 250,000 Jewish refugees like him, but it's also linked to many other stories of, for example, when we speak about Soviet deportations, there are millions of people being deported. This is not just a Jewish story. There is a peculiarity to the Jewish story, but it's not the only story of deportation. So in that sense, it's a slightly different Holocaust story, because it is a story of deportations and migrations and so on. So yes, from the beginning, I wasn't interested in writing a story that would focus just on my father or just on the Jewish experience. In fact, I was truly reluctant to do that. And I think I describe in my book that initially, when I started working with my colleague, Salar Abda, who is a novelist, I basically told him, you should write my father's story because you were a refugee yourself. He was a refugee of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. And you will be able to write this better than I'm too close to the subject. I'm too close to the trauma. At the end, in some ways that changed. I did own my own story, but my story is very open to other people's stories, in part because in every place that I traveled, I had an interlocutor and I had a helper. But that helper, himself or herself, have their own history. And they're not a tabula rasa. And when you start getting into that, you see the linkages between the stories. So the conversations and the linkages are not always easy. The conversations are sometimes hard because these narratives sometimes clash in some cases. And then sometimes during my research for my book, they were fine. And then later we clashed and so on. But at the same time, I think it is my version of multidirectional memory. And I also think it's very necessary to do that. So I'm willing to, or I'm interested in thinking about the Jewish narrative within this much larger context. So my story in some ways is transnational. At the same time, it's also a story about how national identities are formed. Because in the post-war period, many of these national identities, Polish, Israeli, Iranian, come to be national identities in the way that they weren't before the war.
That is very important what you say, that you eventually came to own your story, but that it is also open to other stories. And multidirectional memory, as you say, is not always harmonious and dialogic, but can also involve clashes and confrontations. In your book, we learn how memories interact, but also how and when they part. My next question is, you are a scholar of literature like myself and not a historian. In this case, you had to morph into a historian, inventing a new form of historical writing. What skills and capacities could you draw on? What helped you in the process of creating your book?
Yeah, thank you for this question. Yeah, you know, I'll tell you an anecdote. When W.W. Norton bought the book, or bought the rights of the book, initially they said to me, the editor said to me, look, we're not interested in you like that. We're only interested in this history because this is an unknown Holocaust history, but we don't want to hear your story about your search and so on. It's just boring. So I wanted the contract. I said, okay, I'm going to write this history book. I wrote two chapters. Then the editor came back to me and said, you know, that's really boring. You need to come back into the story and write this in first person from your own perspective. So I think I bring into it, first of all, who I am, right? Both as a scholar, which I'm a comparative literature scholar. I'm also, my background is from Israel, but I live in the United States. All the things that kind of make me who I am are the lens through which I go through this journey. I also describe a journey of understanding this context. And in part, in some ways, I move from being a more theoretical person that I was maybe at the beginning of this book to more of a historian, in the sense that more and more the facts dictate the theory. that I use and not the other way around. So it's a combination, I guess, of both these things. I bring the lens that I was trained in, which is close reading, for example, of testimonies, of non-linguistic body language, let's say of witnesses and so on, comparing sources. But I also allow myself to change my mind and change my interpretation when there's new evidence that comes along. So perhaps I happen to create some kind of more hybrid form of knowledge, which is not completely utopian, but it also is brings in a certain kind of lens through which I see things. I think it ended up being a very valuable, my training as a literary scholar ended up being a very valuable tool to be able to tell the story, not only of what happened, but how we get to, how we understand what happened, how we know what happened, how different groups define what happened, and so on.
It's interesting that you say that you made a transformation from theory to facts and turned the relationship around in a way. I found in your book that in a way you do this also in another way, because usually what historians do is that they have sources, and out of these sources they have to construct some kind of a story. Now, your case is the opposite in a way. You start with a story, the outline of a story, which is the escape and flight and arrival of your father. And now you look for the sources. And this is a really turning history upside down. My question is now, how did you manage? There was not an archive available like for any other historian. All these sources are incredibly dispersed. How did you find them? Did you have a special wishing rod to detect them? I would like to know how you created the archive.
Yes, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I started with this outline of the story, and sometimes I started with the outline of the story that I wanted to be the story, but then I realized that's not exactly the story. And the more I knew, the more nuanced my understanding became. In some ways, it was, as I was finding sources, I was also learning what questions I need to ask, right? And not the other way around. And one of the problems is simply practical. There really aren't a lot of sources about this. There aren't, you know, those Soviet sources were not readily available. Even now, some of these areas where I traveled in, that are in Siberia and in Ural Mountains, it's not that you can just go and say, I'm here and take me to the archive. They're still very Soviet in a way, in many of these areas. You could go there and they'll tell you, the archive is closed for 2 weeks and maybe somebody will have to let you in and so on. So there's a real problem, technical problem with sources, and certainly in Uzbekistan, even more so. I had to make a lot of effort to find sources, sometimes through intermediaries. After I accumulated a lot of sources, I simply sat there for a few years with all the sources and tried to cross them with each other. And so I would be looking at the same story, let's say, from the Zionist archive in Jerusalem and the Polish army archive and the diaries of, let's say, a person who used to be the Polish ambassador to Iran and so on, and try to kind of construct a story out of that. And sometimes I couldn't exactly construct the story, so I would just basically tell the various versions of the story. And this became the story. I do think that in some ways this is more or less the first book that puts all these sources together. And I think there will be other books that will probably bring in even more information and more sources.
But in addition to the sources that you were able to dig up, you also created your own sources with interviews.
Right.
Another very important dimension.
Right.
Which you are adding now.
Right. Yeah. So there were interviews, and in some ways the interviews existed even before. For example, I talk about This film called Yaldei Tehran, Tehran Children, is Israeli documentary film. The interviews are there, but it's like you have the interview without the way to fully understand them. So if somebody says, I was starving in Uzbekistan, what does that mean? Why was there starvation? Who took the food? At what year was that? Did it change a year later? And so on. So in some ways, I was sort of listening very intently and going through my own process of research so I could understand these interviews better. So I both, a lot of times I interviewed people very early on and then went back to the interviews after several years and I understood them in a completely different way because, you know, somebody said one thing and it kind of solved a certain problem that I had in my understanding. So yes, I'm really pleased at those interviews. And in fact, I have a lot of material that didn't make it into the book or that made it partially into the book that I want to make available. And at some point, I plan to create a website with all those sources so other people can use them.
You also created a new narrative for the story of your father. After his arrival in Palestine, he was no longer a Tehran child, but became an Ein Harod child, named after the kibbutz in which he grew up. Janosz Kolczak created this idea of the Ein Harod child. He said he will create the epic of our times because he is born to a new Hebrew life in which many are tired of the past. He must be helped in creating this new epic. But you did the very opposite. You created the epic of the Tehran child. For whom did you create this epic? Was it for your father or was it for yourself?
A lady of such great questions. This is a wonderful question. I guess the answer is both. I mean, of course, unfortunately, my father died already in 1993. But so I guess that would be for me and my generation. So in some ways, I think maybe my father was not the child that Janusz Korczak spoke about, but in some ways I am that child in the sense that I grew up in Israel. I grew up without a kind of the huge burden of Jewish history. I grew up very carefree in many ways. And that was intentional, right? I mean, my father never spoke. Adults around me never spoke about the past, and the idea was that we're creating a new person that will turn their back to the history of Jewish suffering. And in some ways, that was a strength. And ironically, I think that strength is what enabled me to write the book. So it's this absurd thing, right, where in some ways I'm the product of the Jewish nation, which created a person like me, who could in some ways maybe have the guts to do this project or the chutzpah, whatever you call it, or in some ways the ignorance to just say, yeah, I'm going to go to Uzbekistan and maybe it's a dictatorship, but whatever. But also I grew up with, in a way, missing that past, right? And it's a very strange way to grow up without a past. And I think there was a real erasure of that past, especially the Polish Jewish past, but also of this whole journey. So I recreated it, and I feel now I'm in the position where I don't feel that negates what came after, but I think now we should dig that up. And I think I'm not the only one who's doing it. I mean, a lot of Israeli scholars are doing this. I retrieved that past. But I think also that past is much more complex than, of course, I grew up thinking. It's not just a past of suffering. And yes, during the war, it's a past of suffering. But before the war, there was a lot of complexity that was lost in what came after.
Retrieving that past was, of course, was hard work, but you did it in a framework in which others have already created the context,
right,
which made this work possible. But still,
And this links up with what you just said, and I would like to ask you about the role of emotions as a driving force for your memory work. And I would like to refer you also to a recent essay that you published in a Polish paper, where it becomes quite obvious that in the process of your work, your own emotions also change in the very process of writing and learning. So can you say a little bit about these changes and shifts that you experienced yourself in writing the book?
Right. Yes, emotions had a huge role in writing this book. I think more so as I got deeper and deeper into it. It began much more intellectually and distantly. I had a complex relationship with my father, and I was writing this from a distance in a way. But as I was getting closer and closer, I became much more involved emotionally, not only with the story of my father, but with these my interlocutors. There were all these, you know, in some ways they were like all something of a love stories with each, because you go through this emotional experience with another person. But you know, like all love stories, they also became a little bit ambivalent at times and difficult and so on. I don't really separate the emotional side from the scholarly side. In fact, the emotion help understand the scholarship and vice versa. And I'm very interested in this process of that happens to you when you go on a journey like this, where you read it. Let's say I read my father's letters in the beginning, like 10 years ago, whatever, 12 years ago. And they meant nothing to me. I mean, I would read the language, but I wouldn't really feel anything. Whereby after 10 years of research, all of a sudden I could almost hear him speaking. It was such an intimate experience. And not only him, for example, my grandfather, who I never met, right, who was buried in Munich, near here. But I knew so much about him that I could hear how the idioms that he used, and also the kind of politeness and the terms that they used and so on. So it was an emotional process of, in a way, coming close to your past and therefore coming close to yourself. I don't know exactly how to define which emotion, but you could call it love, I guess, as you called it in your prologue. And I think that's really true. So it's a process where the intellectual and the emotional are intertwined.
We can also consider your work as a kind of testimony. And regularly speaking, it could be conceived as a second generation testimony. And there is a genre that is fully developed. And again, Hirsch, our friend, has coined the term post-memory. For this, others have labeled it 2G for second generation. But your work does not fit into this category at all, as far as I can tell, because it's not about the interaction between children and their parents, which is the topic of all the others.
Right.
Now, instead of a 2G testimony, I would like to call it, and here I draw on another term, namely by Jeffrey Hartman, and this is a term that I'm very interested in. I call it the testimony of a secondary witness. And for Hartman, this is a very, very crucial term. It is not necessarily interconnection within the family, but it's important that there is another witness for a witness, because in order for the witness to be a witness, he needs another witness who witnesses. Otherwise, it is immediately gone. So the primary witness is dependent, he needs the sounding board, and maybe even the secondary witness develops and creates this testimony. So how do you place yourself here?
Yeah. Yes, first of all, in relationship to post-memory and other second-generation memoirs, I do think that I veered off to another direction. And in some ways, many second generation memoirs focus on what can't be known, right? On the fragment, on the ghost. In some ways, this book says, first of all, we can know. I mean, there's a lot we can know. It's just, it's hard, it takes a long time to actually research and so on, but there's a lot you can know, and maybe that's where you start, rather than with the absence and so on. So I didn't, that in that sense, it's very different, and it's not really a post-memory book in that sense, even though post-memory, you know, is an incredibly useful term. And yes, I am a witness. First of all, I'm a witness to witnesses, to first generation witnesses. But also I create my own witnessing, and especially I'm also a witness to how the past is remembered today in a lot of different places, in Poland, in Israel, in Uzbekistan, in Iran, in America. So the past is the present, right? The past is not just the past. And when I talk to people and in my conversations, which I describe, I'm a witness to what has remained of the past in these different places. And, you know, by what is remembered, let's say, by a Korean, an ethnic Korean Uzbek in Uzbekistan and so on. So, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, it's actually a great idea to think about what I did in Jeffrey Hartman's terms, because I haven't quite formulated, and I want to write something about my process, but I haven't done that yet. But I do think it's not exactly a second generation memoir in that sense, because it is in some ways an act of direct witnessing, and it's also an act of direct, in some ways, it creates something that wasn't there before, right? So in that sense, it creates its own archive. It creates something that as a in a way first generation witness in some ways.
This is for me right now also very important. You're shifting. We're shifting now in our conversation from the question of the process of the book and the writing and the experience for you to the context in which it is now appearing, and especially your reference to yourself as a witness to the past and the present is so important, because that is quite a new dimension in your book. And here I would like to introduce also an activity of mine, also having to do with Poland in a way. And that is actually petition that I made together with two historians last year, which made it through our parliament, and it will really be evolved and be realized. And this is the plea for a new documentation center in Berlin for all European countries that became victims to Germany's war of aggression and extermination. So this particular scar of the Second World War is still very present and very deeply felt in these countries, but there is very little knowledge of it in Germany, and Poland is a case in point, but also the Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus. So this is the idea behind this center of documentation, is to create also a place of encounter for exchanging memories, for showing, first of all, that their memory is present in Germany. We are still witnessing this past, also in this. We have traces, we can refer to it. We are minding it and reminding us of it. So this, for me, is what I call the development of a self-critical memory within European states. And Germany is, of course, very tensely involved here. The general question now is how inclusive or exclusive are national memories? And I was really struck with Amanda Gorman's poem, in which are the immortal lines when she says, being American is not only the pride we inherit, but stepping into the past and how we repair it. So pitting pride against repairing, I think is a fantastic idea, and also Susan Niemann's book about learning from the Germans, which is very influential right now here, in order to create such a transnational memory is important. Now you are have become an expert for Poland, and I would like to ask you about your impression right now. It is a complicated story, and I just learned from a Polish friend who a couple of years ago, when the Jed Wagner debate was a very hot issue, he was part of this Institute of National Memory back then, Historical Memory, and he said when Jan Gross was severely criticized and eliminated, he said, "I will not be deprived of my right to be ashamed." This is what he said. So this is a dimension of national memory that can be included, but there are many who really do not like it. And in a way, it has become a center of focus of political memory wars. So in which way have you gotten a taste of this strife?
Yeah. Well, of course, I got a taste of this, you know, very directly, because, you know, as it happened, and I write about this in the book, my interlocutor in Poland, Magda Gawin, is now Deputy Minister of Culture of the PIS, of Law and Justice Party in Poland, and very much a force behind the memory politics of the current Polish government. And at the same time, I describe, I think in the book, a very intimate encounter with her. These are all very, very delicate questions, right? And the role of Germany is delicate and interesting, especially because in many ways, I think in Poland and in other post-communist states today, Germany of the past is Brussels of the present. Right. So it's really, and sometimes the memory war is really not about the past, but about the present and about some kind of resentment of countries, you know, kind of feeling second class, I think, in the EU and this sentiment of, you know, Germany is not going to tell us how to commemorate the Holocaust, and they're not going to make us take responsibility for their crimes. And I heard this in Poland directly. Many times. So this question of how these places will commemorate is complicated. But these are, of course, societies that were both, there are societies that are both victims and perpetrators. And oftentimes the same people are both victims and perpetrators. I'm not sure if there is a kind of pure place that you can reach back and reach the truth of things at this point. I went through a process with Poland too, because when I grew up in Israel, I grew up with this, I would say, pretty negative notion of Poland, of people around me, including my father, who said very little, but the sense was very negative. There was a sense of betrayal and the sense of prevalent anti-Semitism that many people spoke about, and simply many people, there are many instances of anger. And I mean, somebody told me the story of a Holocaust commemoration in, I think, the early 1950s, in somewhere in Israel, where the Polish ambassador spoke, and some survivors and people came, and they basically dragged him down from the stage, and they said, "You have no right to speak," and so on. So I grew up on that. And then when I came to Poland, I learned a lot about the suffering of Christian Poles, and I sort of felt like, you know, well, look, we Jews don't own suffering, and in some ways there was something, not that I felt good about it, but there was something, you know, the idea that the suffering was across the board is to me somewhat, makes things somewhat a little bit easier. But then, after, you know, when the discourse became, and as it is in Poland at the moment, we suffered just as much as the Jews, and then it becomes, actually, we suffered more than the Jews, And I think the recent surveys show that at least half of the Polish citizens think that actually Polish Christians suffered as much as Christian Polish Jews and stuff like that, becomes a form of revisionism. And then you become very angry and you start fighting against that. So I think it's very important to try to find that place that allows for this very complicated history of in all of these countries. The problem is there is tremendous revisionism. I mean, in Poland, actually, yes, you have a government that's completely changing history and really inventing a new history, but you also have a whole resistance. I mean, you have really brave scholars who are fighting for the truth and so on. In other places, you don't even have that. I mean, Lithuania, you have, you know, some people who are celebrated as heroes who were like just Nazis and themselves deported many Jews and so on. So it's going to take some time, I think, to find the right way to approach this history. But it is important to do that, because otherwise we're entering another era of Holocaust revisionism, which will be even maybe even worse than earlier eras.
There is, of course, a very close connection between German history, Jewish history, and Polish history. We can perhaps use the term moral triangle to connect these countries and their memories. And I think your book is very important for German readers, because in a way, the story of your father, the flight story, escape story of your father as a refugee starts on the 6th of September, and this is just 5 days after Hitler invaded Poland. So these German troops actually pushed your family out after 8 generations, and this is an incredible effect, you know, which you can only estimate when you have these finely grained stories and you can confront human stories in this context. So I think it is a very important triangle to create the different memories and also to let them interpret each other, open them up to each other. And I think there's another moral triangle that is also possible to necessary, in which Germany is also implicated, and that is Germany, Israel, and Palestine. I recall that one of the reviewers of your book said there is a blind spot in it because it does not speak about the Palestinian refugees who were actually, in a way, in a causal chain linked up with the Holocaust, because this eventually pushed them out of their homeland. So the question is then, I would argue it does not really have a place in the book, because the book has a narrative and a story which is being reconstructed, and that really extends it or would break it up. But it is, of course, a contemporary issue and a context in which this book is, of course, also read. And I would like to ask you about the possibility of creating more awareness for this other moral triangle, and especially with respect to a movement in Israel, which you may know or not know, namely Tzohor.
Yeah, of course.
The attempt of Israelis to teach their fellow citizens the Nakba with the help of Palestinians who do so, and they visit places and they tell stories. And it is a movement that is quite successful in itself. It started in 2003, and even though the inventor, Eitan Bronstein, left Israel because he was too disillusioned, it carries on. The question is, for me, do you see any possibility in Israel for such a movement to pick up some emphasis or power to relate also upwards, it's a grassroots movement, upwards eventually into society and into politics? And if it does not do that, what do you think is hindering this?
Yeah. It's a great question. I mean, to backtrack to how you started about the moral triangle of Poland, Germany, and Israel. I mean, it is a moral triangle, and it's an unsolved moral triangle since. It's especially the strange thing about the story that I tell the story of most Polish Jewish survivors. So most Polish Jewish survivors survived in this way. They fled east and they survived in mostly in Central Asia. These people were actually not recognized as survivors, also legally. So they actually did not receive reparations from Germany. Only in the 2000s that they received a very small sum. So it's not really, so Germany in some ways didn't really take responsibility legally and morally over these people with the, I guess, with the thought that, okay, they survived on the Soviet side. So the Soviets were the aggressors, right? But of course, that's, you know, they didn't just go to a picnic on the Soviet side. I mean, they fled, as you said, because of the invasion. So that's something that has to be solved from the Jewish side, but especially from the Polish side, because the Poles, for example, now there is this huge argument about Jewish property in Poland, which basically has been basically taken and not returned, including my own family's property. And there is no way really to sue for that property. Nobody wins those lawsuits. And so what the Poles say, don't sue us. Go to Hague, sue the Germans. It's not our fault that, you know, you fled and we have your former brewery. So those things need to be addressed today and haven't really been addressed. So in some ways, the story of survivors who survived in the camps and hiding and so on has been addressed, and this hasn't. So that's the first thing. Now to the second question, about Palestinians. First of all, I do touch on it a little bit. When I write about the kibbutz in the last chapter of my book, I do touch on this issue of the refugees and of Israel becoming a country of refugees. And I do think it becomes a country of refugees who have nowhere else to go, but also that creates refugees, that creates new refugees. And in some ways, the next step, the kind of called for next step of my book and my own work is to go there. And it probably will go there, to thinking about Israel, to thinking about my hometown, Haifa, which is a mixed Arab and Jewish city. And I think the work of Zohot is amazing. It's not in the mainstream at all. Is it possible that Israel will create and that it will become in the mainstream? I think it's possible. I think one of the things that hindering it is that, you know, Israelis always feel under attack, right? They feel under attack. They feel, and they are under attack in some ways, and they're under attack, especially, I think they feel sort of pushed to the wall by the West, right, and so on. And so it makes people very defensive. At the same time, with this last round of fighting just now, and with the flaring up of fighting inside Israeli cities, right, in Jaffa and even in Haifa, I mean, I think people, it's changed something. I mean, people have said, you know, what is going on? We need to address something within our own citizenry, right? Jewish and Arab. And I think people are starting to have these dialogue groups, even more centrist people. Because let's say for somebody like me, and again, because I research Poland and I research these other areas, and I live in America, I live in a world of contested histories, and I know it didn't surprise me. It didn't surprise me that under the surface, all of a sudden, all this anger was became visible. But I think a challenge is to keep things separate, but to look for points rather than make analogies of everything being analogous to everything else. You know, Palestine, Israel, Poles, Jews, Germans, to look at each thing at its own terms, but then to find ways of or find intersections, including, let's say, with Jews and Christians in Poland and Arabs and Jews in Israel. And because it, that, I think that does help. It, what Israel, I think, what needs to happen in Israel is some kind of, yes, some kind of acknowledgement of the Nakba. The Nakba needs to be studied in schools. The Arab citizens can't just be, you know, expected to study everything from the kind of Jewish perspective. It's just absurd, and they don't. So something needs to happen, and I think Israel is strong enough to be able to face that path without feeling like its whole raison d'etre is going to crumble. So it should happen, and I'm cautiously hoping that it will happen. But you know, they've, in all of these countries, there are forces in both directions. There are very radical right wing forces and religious forces, and then there is stuff to the opposite. So, but Israel is, you know, in Israel, in many ways, there is much more legal equality, I think, let's say, between Arabs and Jews than, let's say, in America, between African Americans and white Americans. There's more legal equality, there's more equality in education, but there is no common narrative, zero common narrative. And so that needs to happen.
Wow, thank you. That is a strong concluding statement. There is zero common narrative, and that needs to happen. I think you're right. Israel is strong enough to address these issues. So let's hope that Israel will recognize its own strength and trust it. Thank you so much, dear Michal, for your book and all the insights that you have shared with us today. I wish you a good continuation of your trip to Germany and hope that you will return to Konstanz. We definitely need your sensitivity and clarity on these complex issues. So please come back.
I would love to come back. It's wonderful here. Thank you so much for having me and for this wonderful interview. Great questions. Thank you. Later.